On the contrary, I wish to draw £100 now and a bit more later. However, here I paused for a moment. I think you will have no need to look for other venturers. I have lately been asked to invest quite a large sum, more than enough to supply trade goods for several ventures. You wish to venture my entire cargo? He shook his head. I would not advise it, Captain. You know the old saying about putting all one's eggs in one basket? Much as I appreciate your confidence, I would suggest you place your investment in several ships. I can recommend... I was coming to that. I wish at least four other good, substantial men such as yourself. And... I hesitated a moment. Although you may not approve, I would like one other, one who is daring, one who is shrewd, but one willing to take risks if they offer a substantial profit. Before him I placed the largest of the rubies. Do you know gems, Captain? He picked up the stone and took it to the stern light, turning it slowly in his fingers. Coming back, he placed it on the table between us. I know something of gems. My estimate would be around £5,000. I sat back in my chair. Several such stones were entrusted to me, Captain, and I am to invest them as I see fit. The lady who entrusted me professes to know nothing of ventures or the like. But something of men? The Captain commented dryly. You have known her long? I do not know her at all. He shrugged. I have been at sea all my life, Captain Chantry, and have been in many ports and foreign places. I am surprised at nothing. He got to his feet. Very well. I shall make a list of the cargo I have in mind, and will bring it to you. In the meanwhile, I will think of other ship's masters who might be the sort of whom you speak. We walked out on the deck, and at the rail he said, These other ventures... Must they be to the New World? Not at all. In fact, I have heard of the Levant Company, who will trade to the Eastern Mediterranean, largely in raisins, currants and such. I had something of the kind in mind. This other man, the gambler, he's been wishing to chance a voyage around the Cape to India. He has the vessel, he has the crew, and he is an excellent seaman. I will arrange a meeting. After a moment he said, This woman, would she prefer you not to gamble? I shrugged. With you and the others whom you will find, the chances are much in our favour. I think she would be willing to take a flyer. She certainly took a chance on me. Not so much of a chance, Captain Chantry. She was a good judge of men. I wondered afresh. Who could she be? I knew so few women. But obviously at least one knew me. Could she have been Emma Delahaye? This woman seemed much younger and more slender. Moreover, Emma Delahaye could make her own ventures. Captain, I said, who do you think she can be? I mean, what kind of woman? He stared at the crowds along the riverfront. I have been thinking on that. She may be a noble woman who wishes to be wealthier. Or one who fears the future. She may be a mistress of some great man who's been given gems, and is wise enough to know that beauty fades, but gold does not. Or she may be a thief, using this method of turning her stolen jewels into cash. She may also be some fashionable bawd, who realizes that youth fades, and with it, her stock in trade. He paused a moment. Or it may simply be someone who wishes to establish a tie with you. And there is another thought. It may be that some enemy of yours has deliberately given you stolen goods, planning to have you caught in their possession. He turned and looked right at me. Chantry, to be caught with stolen goods could mean hanging. Suddenly, and with awful clarity, I saw it all. It was a trick. Not by Ralph Leckenby, who seemed to have vanished, but his mysterious supporter, the man with the white hair and the cold eyes. The rest of the gems were hidden in my room. Even now, the villains might have come seeking them, and me. I do not think that is the case, I said. But for safety's sake, I think I will accompany my venture to the new world with you. I'd be pleased. But do you not return to the inn without looking about? Indeed I would not. 2 more rubies and 3 diamonds were in my sash, sewn into the material only that morning. The emerald, 3 pink pearls, and the pendant were in my room, but well hidden. One day, years ago, I'd been leaning out the window watching what went on below, when a gust of wind slammed the window at me, and I jerked back quickly, my fingers clutching the edge of the shelf on which I'd been leaning. My fingers had given a sharp tug at the bit of board that trimmed the window ledge, and it had swung out, revealing a cunningly hidden compartment beneath it. From the dust, I gathered nobody had opened it in years, and may not have even known of its existence. Possibly some mechanical-minded guest had contrived it himself for the purpose of hiding something. Into that compartment I had put the remaining gems, closing it carefully and scattering dust along the edge. The window was rarely opened, I knew. The chances were that nobody now alive knew of the place. I had planned to leave the gems there but a short time. Now I knew it might be long before they were removed, for I had decided to remain aboard the ship, and said so to the captain. "Let me take the other gems," the captain suggested. "I will have our friends here to speak with you within the next few hours." Hidden in my clothes was the slip of paper on which was written the name and the place where I could communicate with the mysterious lady. "You go ashore, Captain?"
"There is much to do, Chantry. Much."
"I wish to send a note ashore with you. Can you deliver it to St. Paul's Walk?"
I shall be nigh to it."
From my sash, I took a bit of paper brought from the table in the cabin. On it I wrote, "All is begun. Tell him who sent it. That is all." A week later, I was at sea, bound for the new world. Chapter 29. A hand pressed down on my shoulder, and lips whispered, "Shh, not a sound." Confused, I lay perfectly quiet. The man beside me was Cillamon Turley. Slowly, my mind sorted out the pattern. I was ashore in the new world. The good Catherine had sailed off without me. Close by was the camp of the party who had seized the Spanish people, of whom one was Guadalupe Romana. I lay still and I listened. At first, there was only the faint rustle of leaves overhead, the breathing of Turley, and then a sound of voices, not too far off. I could smell the damp earth, the rotting leaves. Near me on a piece of bark, an ant struggled with some tiny bit of fodder. The voices came again, and they were very close by. "I tell you, there is nothing. She's hard aground in the river, and it will take high water to float her free. She's made a little water, and it looks like somebody has gone through her. Things scattered about, like a search was made of what must have been the woman's quarters." "Nothing at all?" The voice was faintly familiar. "I can't believe it. Like I say, somebody's been through it. But then, she never got where she is by herself. Look, Cap, that passage through the outer island is narrow, and you can bet all you've got that somebody steered through." "There's nobody aboard?" "Not so much as a rat. We went over her, stem to stern. The current's not strong in that river this time of year, and she had some tide behind her, and the wind. She went into the river and jammed herself into the sand, hard and fast aground. No sign of the crew. Like I told you, I found a camp ashore. There'd been some men camped there, but they'd been attacked. Savages, it looked like. We found 8 dead men, dead 3 or 4 days. They might have been a part of her crew. Why? Savages. One had an arrow in him, and the bodies were stripped and mutilated. There was a silence. Say nothing of this to anyone. You can find the ship again? I can. Again, there was a pause. Finally, the second voice said, Cap, looks to me like you had it pegged. The sinking ship was a trick to get them off her and ashore while she was looted. Only something went wrong. I think those men I found dead were supposed to get back aboard her, but they never made it. Savages killed them first. Then the tide, wind, currents, whatever, moved that ship. Maybe somebody helped. Leaves rustled. They could be no more than 20 or 30 feet away. Do you believe that story about the other man? The one who was fixing their boat? The boat is gone, you said. If there was not such a man, what happened to it? Savages? Mayhap. I like none of it, Andrew. There is much going on. The ship gone through, the boat missing. Aye, Andrew replied gloomily. And the vessel of Don Manuel is soon to be here, if the stories be true. We must be ready for them. Cap, I say, slit the throats of this lot, or take what they have and leave them to the savages. Then take Don Manuel's vessel, strip what's worth having from the San Juan de Dios, and be off. We are short of hands as it is, and no need to lose more fighting the savages. Andrew, I want those chests. Our information was good. Part of it was the girl's dowry. Part was to the King of Spain. It was placed aboard the San Juan de Dios. It was seen to go aboard. The vessel has stopped nowhere until now. If it is not aboard, then it is here, and I mean to have it. Andrew, much is at stake. I mean to go back. They will hang you, Captain. Sure as you set foot in England again, they will hang you. Gold can buy much, Andrew, and the Queen needs gold. By the time we return, the way will be smoothed, and when we proffer a gift here and there. Do not worry, Andrew. I know whereof I speak. We kill them, then. When we have milked them of all they know, someone knows where the chests are, and I think it to be one of these. You would kill the woman, too? Though she knows where Inca gold may be, what is that to us? They can move about in Peru, as they are Spanish, and perhaps they can find it. We could not move freely there, for we should be discovered and killed. Unless she knows something of the chests, she is of no use to us, and could be much trouble. You are still thinking of England? Andrew said gloomily. I still say you should find another place, an island of our own, from which we can sail our ships. Even a place on the shores of France. I know a... Talk no more to me of that. England is my home, and it is England where I would be. They moved off, talking still. Turley lifted his hand from my shoulder.
I was afeard you'd come awake, noisy-like. They was right over us.
We've got to think of something, or they will kill them all.
Aye.
Turley agreed.
A bloody lot they are.
But there's two of us. Not enough to do much. We waited and watched, yet nothing offered us a chance. We must do something. Alarm them. Create a diversion. Ideas came and were discarded, yet there had to be a way. Guadalupe was alerted, for I was positive she had seen me, that her signal had been based on something she knew. There must be some reason for our holding back. I saw Conchita bring a cup of something, coffee probably, to Guadalupe. They whispered together, I was sure, although they did not seem to do so. Conchita left, carefully not looking toward us. Soon Armand, the Basque, came to the fire and squatted beside it, taking a piece of meat that had been broiling. As he ate, he looked across the fire and up at the slope where we were hidden. Conchita had gone back to where Guadalupe Romana was sitting, and was straightening some clothes she had washed, folding them, taking her time. Armand straightened up from the fire, wiping his hands on his pants. At that moment, Felipe came from the trees, bringing an armful of firewood. He dropped it, dusted off his hands, and walked away toward the woods, past the two girls. Armand followed.
Turley! I touched his arm.
Look! They are going to try to escape. Can you create a diversion? Distract the others. He glanced at the camp, and then, like a ghost, he was gone into the woods. How he moved so swiftly, I could not guess. But suddenly, at least 200 yards off, I heard the cry of a wolf. A long, quavering howl that rose, quivered in the still air, then died away. It was such a howl as made the hair stand on the neck. Even I who knew, or suspected, that the wolf was Silliman Turley, was startled. An instant later, a large stone suddenly landed in the very center of the fire, scattering burning logs and embers. A series of weird whooping calls came from the woods. And below in the camp, all was turmoil. Some of the captors ran for their muskets, which had been left rather carelessly stacked against a tree. Others drew their swords, rushing to the edge of camp. A quick glance toward where Guadalupe had been showed that she, Conchita, Armand, and Felipe had vanished. Moving quickly, I took a route that I calculated might intersect theirs. I was not as good in the forest as Turley, but even the few days I had been there had taught me a little. I ran, as swiftly and silently as possible. They had run into the thickest of the woods, and now I came upon them. Without doubt, their captors were already searching for them. I must get them far away, or into some kind of hiding. Turley's place was best, but I knew I could not find it, nor could I find him, so I must trust him to find us. Leading them through a shallow stream and up the opposite bank, I turned downstream as swiftly as possible, weaving away among the close-growing trees. All the while, my mind raced ahead. The captors would be able to put no more than a few men to hunting for us. Some of their people must be left to guard Don Diego and his party. Nonetheless, they could be upon us within minutes. We came into a thick stand of what Turley had called chestnut oaks, fine tall trees, growing very straight and thick. There was little brush there, and we ran more swiftly. Yet I kept looking around at the girls to see how they came. Despite their skirts, which they gathered in their hands and held high, they both ran well. I saw an opening between the trees and led the way off along the hillside. Glancing back, I saw that Conchita had fallen, but was getting up. I could see Guadalupe's breast heaving with effort. "I am afraid. I cannot." "We will go slower," I told her. Then we went over the ridge into the forest beyond. That we were pursued, I had no doubt. Suddenly, I was face to face with Silliman Turley. "How far is it to your place in the swamp?" I asked him. He hesitated, suddenly uneasy.
"'Tain't far. Only..."
"Only what?"
"Don't think I'm back enough. But a place that will hide one man who does mighty little moving around mayn't hide all of us. The savage has never found that place of mine. But surely as I take so many in, they will. Be no use to me more, and it's a tidy spot.
You won't need it much longer, Turley. You'll be coming away with us."
"Don't calculate on it. This here's a good land. I've been thinking a sight since you showed up, and I ain't at all sure I want to leave. Maybe they'll fetch my scalp sometime, but this here's a good country. There's plenty of fish, there's game in the woods for the taking, and you know, back to home, a man could get hanged for killing a deer or even a rabbit. All the game back there belongs to the queen or the gentry. Here, I got only to kill it and butcher it. Then there's roots, nuts, fruit about,
whatever a man could want. Of course, I do miss the bread, and I miss setting over a glass with friends. I do miss that. There will be settlements here, I commented. It won't be long.
Here? You're mad.
Who'd want to leave all that behind and come out here where there's nothing to drink but branch water? Maybe a few wild ones like me, but...
Let's go to your place, Turley. We don't have any choice. They'll be finding us soon.
All right,
he agreed reluctantly. The brush was thick the way he went, and he wove an intricate pattern, turning back and forth, doubling on his way, occasionally returning to straighten up grass and conceal the trail. After a half hour of steady travel, we paused. Glancing at Turley, I said, "Where are you taking us? This way doesn't ever seem to have been travelled."
"It ain't been. That's why the savages can't find me. I never use the same route twice."
We walked on, and now he seemed to be seeking something along the river's bank. He turned abruptly and walked into the water. Halfway across, he said,
"Walk right behind me. But take a step wrong, right or left, and you'll go into 30 feet of water."
2 feet below the surface of the water were two logs, side by side, a bridge hidden under water and virtually invisible. One by one we crossed, following him closely. Had he not guided us, we could never have found our way. Almost 2/3 of the way across, he stopped.
"This here is pretty fancy. You see that blaze on the tree? The one over on the point?"
"I see it."
"When that blaze is faced right towards you, stop. Then feel underwater on the side toward the blaze. You'll find more logs. Track turns at right angles there. Then you got to count. Take 10 steps, no more, no less. Then you feel on the side nearest the nigh bank, and you'll find the rest of the bridge. Once a body knows his way, you can just about run it if you're sure-footed."
When we reached the bank, he led us into the swamp. Here and there were hummocks of earth, usually carrying a stand of cypress. Turley still twisted and turned. Most of the time we were on dry ground, occasionally wading through thick patches of reed, often a tangle of trumpet vine. We came at last to a narrow hummock of earth and a narrow path through thick brush. At the end of the path was a body of deep water. Beyond the water lay acres upon acres of reeds, growing very tall. Turley went past me and moved off to the left 12 feet, then put his hand in the water alongside a rotting log. When his hand lifted, it held a rope which arose from the water across the narrows. Water fell dripping from the rope as he held it. Then he gave a tug, and a log slid from among the reeds. He reeled in the rope, pulling the log across, and when the end of the rope reached him, he guided it into a notch in the rotting log, where the rope had lain. Then he walked out on the log, and we followed, balancing as best we could, to reach the far side of the water. Once there, he drew the log back into the reeds. He led us through the reeds along a muddy ridge we had not seen from the opposite side, until we reached a raft of logs moored in an open place among the reeds. On the raft was built a crude circular hut of branches and slabs of bark, and close to it a lean-to. On a rack nearby a hide was stretched. Deer, I presumed. Under the lean-to were baskets of chinkapin and hickory nuts. Turley had told me the Indians used them not only to eat as they were, but to make bread from the meal, or thicken their soup. We tried it that night, and a very wholesome thing it was, and goodly to eat. Once upon the raft we rested, for all were weary from much walking up and down dale, and through swamp and brush. Nor were we free from fear, for our enemies would not soon give up their chase. The big man, their leader, had been abroad searching for the San Juan de Dios, or else our escape might have ended in disaster,
He had taken a number of his men with him. My own treasure worried me, for hidden though it was, they might come upon it. I reflected how a man cannot be free until he has possessions, and then he is no longer free, but bound by them. Now I had but one desire, to be free of this land, to secure my treasure, and escape to sea where we might come upon a ship, even the good Catherine, for their intent was to trade along this shore. Guadalupe Romana looked upon me with cool eyes. "You have freed us from them," she said. "Now what do you propose to do?"
"Get away to the sea. Find there a ship that will take us to England or some foreign land. Once there, we can be secure and arrange for our futures."
She raised an eyebrow. "You would plan my future?"
"Nothing would please me more," I said, surprising myself at the words, but adding very hastily, "Yet I would hesitate to more than suggest. Safety in England would give us time to plan, and perhaps we can arrange for you to return to Peru."
She shrugged. "I was not safe there before. Why should I be again?"
"Perhaps to return to one of those hidden places still maintained by the Incas," I suggested.
"I escaped from there too," she admitted.
"Nor can I well return.
All this can be decided at another time. Now it is enough to bring you alive into England, and with our friends." For a moment there was silence, and then I said, "Señorita, I too know what it means to escape. I had to flee my own land. Even in England, if they discovered who I was, I would be in danger. I would say this to none but you, but I wish you to know that I do understand." We rested, then ate, then rested some more. Silliman Turley and I talked, and from time to time I translated for Armand and Felipe, although the former, having been a fisherman, had picked up some words of English. The original plan of the good Catherine had been to trade to the south as far as the mouth of the Savannah River, avoiding any contact with the Spanish, and then to turn about and come back up the coast. This she might already have done, although I'd been but a few days ashore and doubted there had been time. There was every chance she might come again along the coast. She might, and she might not. In any case, I must recover my boat and its treasure. Chapter 30. "Before the first light," I suggested, and they agreed, content now to rest. Over a slight fire, built upon a bed of flat stones, Turley, with Conchita's help, made a gruel and some cakes, using the nuts for meal. There was smoked fish as well, and we were hungry. It was a tidy place he had here, and it spoke well for Silliman Turley. He was no idler, but a workman, competent with many skills. "I have a boat," I said, "a ship's boat. It is loaded, but will still carry us all if we can reach it." With the fire out, the night was very dark, yet bright with stars. We heard vague sounds, and a sort of whoosh, as some great bird, an owl no doubt, swept by on wide, slow-moving wings. The girls could have slept in the house, if such it could be called, but they preferred the cooler outside air. Guadalupe was no more sleepy than I, so we sat together, listening to the sounds of the night and watching the stars. "Where was your home?" she asked. "I mean, when you were very young." I told her, choosing my words with care and without naming places of my boyhood. I told her what little I remembered of my mother and of my father and his teaching, of his sharing with me those things he loved, the beauties of the wilder world, and the love of learning, and of pleasure in the word. "You loved it, and yet you left." "My father was killed. Part of my home was in flames. Whether it was the house or the stables, I know not. I escaped, and they pursued." "But you did get away."
"That I did, but only because my father had expected that day, and had taught me well.
each possible route we might take, and what I must do if alone, where I must go. If you go back, will they know you? I think not. The name I shall use now is another name, and I shall return to the place from England. A few about may know the look of me, but the ones who know will never speak. There I shall go, and there I shall live. She sat close to me in the darkness, and told me of her Andes mountains, and of the far land beyond those mountains where she had lived. But she, too, mentioned no names, and it pleased me that she was wary, although she had others to protect, and I did not. At last, she went away to lie near Conchita and to sleep, and I slept too, awakening, shivering, in the first chill moments before the dawning. Turley was awake also, and he brought the canoe around. A dugout canoe it was, but good enough. We loaded into it what we required and pushed off. There was a soft rain falling and no great visibility, which was helpful in avoiding our enemies, or would be if they appeared. We held close to the southern shore of what was obviously a large sound, a place of only brackish water, affected by the tides and also by the fresh water flowing down from several rivers that rose somewhere far inland. Turley sat in the bow, as it was he who knew the way, and Armand held the steering oar, guided by gestures from Turley. I sat amidships, keeping my weapons dry under my blanket, or so I hoped. We had been moving an hour before day came, only a vague greying of the mist about us. We glided through the still water like a ghost boat, shielded or at least screened by the mist-like rain. We had far to go. We crept from the swamp into open water, holding up for just a minute close against a wall of reeds to study the sound. All was still. We could see less than 100 yards. Felipe and I now took up our paddles and the canoe moved forward, gaining speed. Water dripped from our paddles when we lifted them. A huge old snag lifted suddenly from the water, like the head of some primeval monster, and Turley's gestures guided us around it. Ahead, there were patches of outlying reeds, and we went between them. We saw nothing, heard nothing, but the occasional lonely cry of some gull overhead. The sky above was clearing. The rain ceased. Yet suddenly the sky was darkened again, and looking up, we saw an immense cloud of birds. Turley looked around at me. "Passenger pigeons," he said. "The savages kill them for their oil. Knock 'em down with a long pole when they are roosting. I've seen 'em killed by the thousands. Good eating, too." "Turn in toward the shore," I said. "Toward that lightning-struck pine." We eased in toward shore, stepping off to a log which lay half in, half out of the water. I told them, "I'll not be long." Swiftly I moved, holding to solid ground when I could find it, until I was safely among the trees, mostly cypress and swamp gum, mingled with a few pines. Walking the log again, I got back to the narrow, sandy islet where my boat had been hidden. It was still there. A hasty check showed me that nothing had been changed. Taking in the painter, I shoved off with an oar, pushing the boat back out of the narrow waterway in which it had been snugged down. Once clear of the islet, I settled the oars in place and pulled strongly, with a glance over my shoulder from time to time, to maintain the proper heading. Yet for all of that, it was nearly an hour until I came alongside the canoe. The boxes were covered by a tarpaulin, brought from the ship. Despite the heavy load the boat carried, there was plenty of room for the others. Silliman Turley got out, and with Felipe's help, got the canoe ashore and turned bottom up. There was no sign of the big man or his followers, no evidence of Don Diego or Don Manuel. Yet I doubted I had seen the last of them, and was eager to be away. Once in the boat, we wasted no time, but hoisted our sail and moved off. Guadalupe came aft to sit by me in the stern, where I held the tiller. She indicated the tarp-covered mound in the boat's centre. What is it there?
Some food from the San Juan de Dios, some of my things, and some of yours.
Mine?
I was aboard the ship. I found some of your clothing, so I bundled it up to bring to you.
May I have it?
Not yet. I don't want to loosen that tarp, and the less moving around we do, the better.
A thought came to me.
Turley, there's several muskets under that canvas. They'd better be checked, but I left them charged. There's powder and shot there, too.
He dug under the canvas and got out the muskets. He looked them over with satisfaction.
All ship-shape, Captain.
His eyes swept the horizon. Nothing in sight but the distant shore.
Where are we heading for?
South by a little west, right down the sound. There's an inlet runs through the bank there into a little cove behind Cape Lookout. That's where we're going.
After a bit, I said, it's a chance we have to take.
The good Catherine should be beating back up the coast by now. The skipper told me he sometimes used that cove to lie up in.
Anyway, it's our best chance of sighting him.
Turley was quiet for a moment.
What we don't know is where the pirate ship is. If they are pirates.
The clouds were low, and the wind held fair. Off to our left now, we could see the long yellow line of the inner side of the bank that broke the force of the sea. It was a long, narrow island, stretching away for how many miles I knew not, but 50 or 60 miles of which I knew. The Atlantic side was straight and smooth, offering no inlets, no passages for most of its length. On the inner side, facing toward the sound, the shore of the bank was broken by many small, sandy islets and shoals. An hour passed. I glanced at the sky. Only clouds, broken here and there now, showing patches of blue. We could not see the Atlantic across the dunes of the outer banks. Had a ship been there, we would have missed it. Who were those men? I asked suddenly of Guadalupe. How did they come upon you?
I know not.
Suddenly, they were all about us, and we had no chance. Yet they seemed to know who we were, and where we had come from, and they addressed both Don Diego and Don Manuel by name. They said Don Manuel had a ship soon to be here.
I heard them speak of that. The San Juan de Dios was never in danger of sinking. She had only made water, I do not know how, and somehow they managed to frighten Don Diego.
He knows nothing of the sea. He is much thought of as an administrator, but he has crossed the sea but once, and knows it not. She watched the sea for a moment, then said, there was one among them, not much older than you, I think, who seemed a not bad man. He would have helped us had he been able, and I believe he intended to. He said their captain was interested only in money and power. They were all Englishmen, I believe. The wind seemed to be picking up. I eased the tiller to bring us a little closer to the outer island. On the chart I'd been shown the cove behind Cape Lookout and the narrow inlet that led to it from the sound. Turley glanced at the sky, and then at me. The clouds were building up, and the southeastern sky had a yellow look that I did not like. Turley and Armand were taking in sail. Suddenly, Turley seemed to stop all movement, looking back over my head.
"Sail ho!" he yelled then.
Turning, I looked aft, a pinnace by the look of her, three masts and a good ship under sail. She was crowding on all canvas, trying to overtake us. Obviously, she had come from behind one of the shoreside islands, and was no more than a half mile off and closing fast. Another glance shoreward told me we were coming up to the coastal banks and fast, but none too fast. Yet the pinnace drew more water than we, and would not dare, or so I hoped, follow us much further. Guadalupe leaned closer to me. Tatten. It was the first time she had called me that. Don't let them take me. Those men, the way they looked at me and talked about me. I'd rather die.
I won't, I replied grimly. I'll see them all in hell first.
My words were brave, but the pinnace was coming on swiftly. When I glanced at them again, they seemed to be making ready with a bow gun. Yellow was the sand on the long isle eastward. Yellow under the dull grey sky where the winds lurked. There was a distant flash of lightning and a roll of thunder, and I could hear the beat of the waves upon the outer shore. Salt spray spattered my face, and from behind me I heard a dull boom that was not thunder, and then a whishing from overhead, and a shot plunged into the sea some 20 yards beyond us. Too close to give me pleasure. An island, a small sandy key, loomed on our right. We slid behind it, with the outer bank closing on our left. I glanced back. The pinnace was coming on, although under shortened sail. There was a shoreline ahead of us too, not much more than a mile away. The pinnace fired again, but again the shot passed overhead.
We will need the muskets, I said to Turley.
He nodded. He had shortened sail because of the wind. Now, sheltered by the islands, he raised the sail again, and we moved more swiftly. The gun boomed again, and again it was a miss, but closer, much closer.
Captain, Turley said.
I glanced around. The pinnace was hove to and lowering a boat. Men were getting into it. Guadalupe said quietly, I can fight, Tatten, and I can shoot. And I'd not mind shooting any of them, for they are a bad lot, except for Tosti, that is. Something within me stopped cold.
Who?
I said. Tosti, she replied. Tosti Paget. Chapter 31. That one who had been lying on the ground. No wonder he had seemed familiar. Tosti Paget here, and a pirate? Yet, why not? He'd been drifting at loose ends, with no destination in view. Yet, how had he come to this? The wind had fallen, for we had glided into that narrow channel that led into the cove, and the sandbanks and trees on either side caught the force of the wind. Armand and Felipe were bending to the oars, but ours was a lost cause. Glancing back, I saw the ship's boat clearing the side of the pinnace with at least a dozen rowers. Again I looked ahead. Turley was rowing also, but with a musket by his side. I recovered my own from beneath the tarp and looked to its charging, then the pistols. The wind touched my cheek, but it barely filled the canvas, helping us not enough. Mentally, I made the calculation, and if my judgment was correct, we would reach the cove on the other side just about the time they came up with us. Yet what had I to expect of that haven which we sought so desperately? Exactly nothing. Ships used it for shelter from the storms, and one such seemed to be building, for the clouds were swelling into great masses off to the southeast, and the wind blew in fitful, spiteful gusts. The good Catherine had used this place, but that she would be there was unlikely, or that she would take part in a fight that seemed to have nothing to do with her. Unfortunately, I had been given up for dead long since. Guadalupe, I said, can you steer a boat?
I often have.
Here then, I think some shooting is in order. If the wars had taught me anything, it was something of muskets. Beyond 100 yards, their aim was a chancy thing. Yet it was worth a gamble. And with a little elevation... Putting my back against the boxes covered with the tarpaulin, and settling myself down, I lifted the musket.
Lie down, I told her.
She did as she was bade, as did Conchita, and I took a careful sight, then touched off my shunt, tilting the gun to get proper elevation. I had no great confidence in the weapon, but my shot landed among them, although with what damage I knew not. Yet they fell off for a moment, and seemed none too anxious to provide me with a second chance. My second was a clear miss, yet not by much, for it hit the gunwale and bounced off into the sea. Shooting at such a distance was unheard of, yet I had noticed the balls carried further than expected, although without accuracy. I deduced that given proper elevation, a ball would drop among them. The pinnace itself was now coming slowly, taking soundings as it came. Suddenly, we emerged into the cove, and wonder of wonders, a ship lay there at anchor. It was the Good Catherine. I stood up and whooped loud, waving my hat vigorously. But although somebody seemed to be watching us through a glass, I doubted they could see much. Spyglasses were found on some ships now, but few were of much value. Turley shook loose the sail, and we made for the Good Catherine. Heavy laden as we were, we made but slow time, and the boat from the pinnace closed in swiftly. It was Guadalupe who got off the next shot, and it struck matchwood from the gunwale. Turley rested his musket on the tarp-covered cases and fired. His shot also scored. We saw one man drop his oar and rise up, and my ball took another. The boat swung off, and we saw the big man rise up, sword in hand, gesturing at the others. More afraid of him than of us, they set to work. But we had gained a little, as we had our sail, and they had none. Suddenly, there was a shout from Felipe. He was pointing, for the pinnace had cleared the inlet and was coming straight for us. "Can you swim?" I asked Guadalupe. "If you can, you and Conchita head for the Good Catherine. Tell the captain you're friends of mine, and he will stand by you." She looked at me for a long moment. "And you?" "We will keep them busy," I said. "I got these lads into this, and I'll not see them suffer alone." By then, I'd recharged my musket. Armand and Felipe had taken up theirs. "Take turns," I advised. "Don't let them catch us with an empty gun." We were still moving, and now there seemed to be action aboard the Good Catherine. Armand fired toward the boat and missed. Felipe did not. His shot was well aimed, but the boat was drawing closer. His ball hit the man at the tiller, for he had gotten a good shot. The man leaped to his feet, clawing at his chest, then tumbled into the water. The boat swung wide and lost distance. The Good Catherine was moving now, moving to cut off the pinnace. Suddenly a gun boomed, and we saw a round shot skip the waves across the bow of the pinnace. The pinnace promptly replied, and the master of the Good Catherine proved himself. He let go a broadside of four well-aimed guns. The first holed the pinnace a point abaft the beam, and just above the waterline. Another shot smashed the bowsprit and brought down the forestay. What happened to the other two shots I never knew, for at that moment their boat came alongside ours. Turley fired into the boat, as I did. Then, grasping my two pistols, I fired again, once with each. "Tosti!" I yelled. "You're on the wrong side!" He leaped to his feet, staring at me, and then the big man lunged from the stern of the boat, and I was staring into the eyes of Rafe Leckenby. A shout from the pinnace tore his eyes from me. She was bearing down upon us, not answering to her whipstaff, for he who manned it must have been killed. The Catherine was also coming up fast. Sheathing my blade, I ran forward to throw her a line. The pinnace, running blind, sheered into Leckenby's boat and ran it down, just as my line was taken by the Catherine. For a time, all was confusion. Leckenby's men were swarming aboard the damaged pinnace as his longboat sank. Not 60 feet away, Guadalupe and Conchita were being helped aboard the Catherine. Armand and Felipe came to help me lash lines around the boxes. One after another, they were hoisted aboard, and at last I stood on the deck. Gesturing to the boxes, I said, "Take them below, to my cabin." A glance toward the pinnace showed the two vessels were drifting apart. The pinnace was damaged, but nothing beyond repair. Leckenby was aboard there. Rafe Leckenby, of all people. I stared after his boat with almost a hunger in my heart. Never had I wanted so much to fight a man, to meet him face to face. Had he been the man who led the attack on my father's house, I could have been no more eager. Would this be our last meeting? Knowing the man, I knew it would not. He was never one to give up. I knew that from our first meeting he had meant to kill me, and not for an instant had the thought left his mind, nor mine. Was it that I doubted myself? Was it because he had made me feel fear, knowing the closeness of death? There was a savage hunger in me, a hot desire to cross blades with him, to end once and for all what lay between us. For with him alive, I would never know peace. Always I must be on guard, certain that he would strike at me in the way I could be most hurt. For Leckenby, to kill was never enough. He enjoyed making other men suffer. And now I was vulnerable, for now I loved. Yes, in that moment I admitted it. For the first time I confessed it to myself. For better or worse, I loved Guadalupe Romana. Not the Irish girl of my dreams, but a lass from the high Andes. A girl of another blood, another way of life. She I loved. And neither of us could ever know safety, as long as Rafe Leckenby lived. Now was the time. Captain Dabney was on his poop deck, and I went to him. "Pursue them," I said. "We cannot let them escape. There is a man aboard there whom I..." He interrupted. "Captain Chantry, you are now aboard my ship. Yours is most of the cargo aboard, but the vessel is mine. I shall not risk it in needless pursuit of some reprobate you wish to fight." He brushed lint from his sleeve. "You were in grave danger, so I came to your help. Now you are safe, and I see no reason to risk either the vessel or a single man of my crew in order to follow up a fight that is yours alone. Do you think he will lie quietly by, knowing I am aboard and have what he wants? He will not. He will attack at first chance." "Very well, then. If he attacks, we will defend ourselves. But if we can avoid his attack, we will do so. I do not command a ship of war, Captain, nor a privateer. I am a simple merchant seaman, and I shall do my best to return the investment of those who ventured with me, of whom you are one." He turned and looked me up and down. "I would suggest, Captain Chantry, a bath, a change of linen, and a good night's sleep. In the morning you will think better of your insistence." Ashamed, I shrugged. "You may be right, Captain. I am a fool." "Not a fool, Captain. No man is a fool who can survive ashore there and come back aboard with a lovely lass and whatever is in those chests. I imagine you have done well." He gestured toward the pinnace, limping away toward the inlet. "If you are wise in your judgment of that man, whomever he may be, he will come upon us when he can. Better get some sleep." "The man aboard there," I said, "is Rafe Leckenby." "Ah, the man who was driven from London. So this is what he came to. Well, well." "Yes, I think we shall see more of him." He bowed. "Captain Chantry, a good night to you." "A good night? With Rafe Leckenby alive? Would there ever be a good night until I had faced him again?" Chapter 32. Surprisingly, I slept. Not the night through, but for several hours, The bath I had, and the change of linen, lay hard by my bunk and ready for use. Yet when I awakened, it was not the clash of arms that brought me from a sound sleep, nor a woman's scream, but the sound of the wind. Our harbour back of Cape Lookout was a snug one. If any harbour is snug when a hurricane blows. The main force of the wind came, at first, from the southeast, and that was the point of our best protection. But even there, the land was not high. The waves broke on the outer shore, but the wind swept, almost unimpeded, across the low dunes that made up the point. The Good Catherine was a snug vessel, her crew well chosen and tautly disciplined, the ship herself well kept and secure. Knowing the sort of man Dabney was, I felt secure despite the wind, and so did we all. I heard it from the crew when we went on deck. For I could not lie abed with the wind blowing at such strength. Awakening, I dressed to be prepared for any emergency, and was about to go on deck when the door to Guadalupe's cabin opened a crack. "Tatten, is the storm very bad?" "It is bad," I said, "but we're in as good a place to last it out as there is along this coast. The vessel is a strong one, and our captain an excellent seaman. If there is serious trouble, I will come to you." Suddenly a thought occurred to me. "Will you wait, Guadalupe? I have something for you." Hastily I returned to my cabin, where all was battened down and secure, and took from among the chests the one containing her clothing. It was the largest of all, but not heavy for one of my strength, and I took it to her. When she saw what I had, she drew back the door, remaining behind it, and I placed the chest just inside the room. I showed her hooks upon the wall, low down. "Lash it, or it may break a leg for you. The lines are there." Stepping out, I went on deck quickly, and after a moment heard the door close, just as I was leaving the passage. Sheets of driving rain swept the deck like volleys of grape shot, and the sky was weirdly lit by continuous flashes of lightning. Grasping the ladder, I went to the poop deck where Dabney stood, his legs spread wide to take the roll of the ship. He saw me and lifted a hand. When I drew near, he shouted above the storm, "She's holding well! I think we may have no trouble!" Several men were about the deck, but no more than would be around on any watch. Dabney was sparing of his men, as of all else. Standing beside him, I watched the rain and spray blow through the rigging and sweep the deck, and thought of those far out at sea, or worse, those who had been caught sailing off the shore. Many a fine ship would go down this night, or be beached out yonder, and torn apart by the waves. In such a gale as this, the safest place, unless one lay as we did, was far at sea. Often I'd heard landlubbers talking of ancient seafarers staying within sight of land, which was absurd, as it was by far the most dangerous place to be. What with rocks, sandbars, shoals, and contrary winds, or unexpected capes on an unmapped coast. During a lull in the roar of the wind, I said, "I thought you might need a hand, so I came on deck." "Kind of you, Captain, but I suggest you go below and have your rest. By the look of you when you came aboard, I'd say you need it." He glanced at me. "How is the lass making it?" "Fine enough. She heard me in the passage and asked if all was well. I assured her we had a sound ship and a sounder master. I hope she went back to sleep." "Aye." He seemed pleased at my confidence. "You do the same, Captain. I might add that our trading to date has been profitable. Very profitable." Below, I did not lie down at first, being too much awake. Catching hold of the table, I eased myself onto one of the settees against the bulkhead and took a book from the shelf, where they were held in place by a strip of moulding. It had been long since there had been time or opportunity to read, and I sorely missed it. The books upon the shelf were not the same as those it held when last I was aboard. Evidently, those had been replaced by a store the captain maintained below decks. One was called Tariq al-Hind, and the language was strange to me. I was